another Netcast production brought to you by the Fancy Pants Gangsters at FancyPantsGangsters.com.
It's time to cool it out, baby.
Twin City Stank, this is Pete. Over there's Brent.
Hi.
How are you doing, Brent?
I'm fantastic right now.
This is our first show on the
Fancy Pants Gangsters
Network.
There you go.
And from now on, you got to go to
FancyPantsGangsters.com
to download our episodes. If this is the first time listening to it and you have resubscribed, go to
FancyPantsGangsters.com
and you'll get details on how to... No, it's a fucking... go to
FancyPantsGangsters.com
for details on how to resubscribe and enter a contest to win a $50 gift card to iTunes. All right, now that shit's out of the way. Let's get the show started. Going around the room here, aside from me and Brent, we have Drew Ailes sitting in on the interview again today.
Hello.
And, of course, our special guest is Shannon Selberg from The Cows and from Heroin Sheiks. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Very good.
You fancy pants gangster.
God damn it.
Seal has been broken.
Yes, the fourth wall. Now, this is a treat for me, being probably one of the bigger Cows fans in the world.
Oh, shucks.
Yeah, I'm just going to start it off. 1996, I was 15 years old. There was a matinee show. It was Jesus Lizard, Cows, Heroin, Six Finger Satellite. My brother was leaving for college.
He's told me about this at 4 in the morning before.
My brother, the last thing that he did before he left for college, before he wasn't going to see me for a while, was take me to that show. First actual real, show that I went to. You came out, I think you were wearing a sparkly green suit, something like this. Very first thing you do was do a headstand, kick some people in the face. That moment, literally, my life went burp, huge right turn, left turn, whatever you want to call it. Everything that happened since then was literally directly influenced by that show.
I'm like, Jesus.
Seeing what rock and roll actually looks like up close as a kid, and not seeing it from AC/DC or on a big stage, seeing what it actually really was. Literally flipped everything that I knew on its ear, and I just became obsessed with everything AMREP, but specifically Cows, and it was a huge turning point in my life. That's my story. That was my first exposure to Cows. Do you want to kind of get off started? Let us know where the band started.
Let me talk about that show for a second.
Sure.
Because we got compared to the Jesus Lizard a lot. And,
yeah.
Well, you guys just ripped off the Jesus Lizard, and I'm like, well. That's interesting, since we were around a couple years before they started.
Right.
But that was the only show we ever played with the Jesus Lizard.
Yeah.
And we played an all ages and a drunk show. And, it was the big showdown.
Yeah.
And,
you guys weren't like buddy-buddy with them at this point. You just played one show.
Well, no, we knew them.
Yeah.
As individuals. But the first show... David Yao, I had this really fancy outfit stashed in the dressing room, and in the middle of a song, he goes backstage, and he comes out in my clothes,
oh, shit.
And he tears them off and throws them into the audience.
Oh.
How did you take that at the time?
Well, I thought it was kind of funny, but I didn't know what I was going to wear, and so they kind of beat us in that show, and we got the attitude, well, no one smokes the Cows twice, right. So yeah. It was on after that.
Yeah, it was I think, maybe the better part of one song before you were in the audience at that particular show doing a headstand. And it was probably right when Horn came out, I think.
Right, it's probably Shitbeard.
Yeah, more than likely. And it was about... half the crowd stunned looks and half the crowd just getting their fucking asses kicked, and it was literally, like I said, it was the turning point in my actual like growth into like actual decent music.
You're doing great, man.
Look at you now, buddy.
If you don't like me now, blame this guy. It's a big part of it.
Well, I like you.
So cows start, what, 86, 87-ish?
I believe 87.
Okay. What was the... And I know that it was you... Was it you, Thor, and Kevin right away?
Me, Thor, Kevin, and Kevin's brother, Sondris, on the drums.
And what
Sondris
was the...
just did the one record, right?
He was just on the first one, yeah.
Right.
And he was on the Chow single.
Okay.
They were together before you joined, right? Is that...
Right. They used to all work at a home for retarded children, and they would play... Well, they started out playing covers, like on Christmas and Thanksgiving and Halloween and stuff.
Okay.
Didn't we talk about this?
Yeah, I believe
so. A few weeks ago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there.
You were there?
No.
No.
That was where I grew up, actually.
So you haven't made that big of a turn.
That's just now we're just older and drunker. So they would play covers for the retarded kids at the home?
Right. Okay. I never saw that, but originally Norm Rogers was the singer.
Okay,
and he
ended up drumming eventually, right?
He ended up drumming. He quit the Jayhawks to drum with us.
Interesting. Interesting.
How does he feel about that decision now?
We'd be out on tour, and we'd pass a marquee that said Bob Dylan with the Jayhawks opening, and he was kind of bummed out about that. Or Johnny Cash and the Jayhawks.
Yeah. Well, whatever. I think you guys won anyway. So...
But Norm was singing, and I happened to catch one of the shows, and he didn't really enjoy singing much. He was very nervous and beat red, and I'd never wanted to be in a band or anything like that.
Was he just pushed to be the singer because no one else was doing it, or did he make the decision and then decide that it wasn't really his thing? Or?
Well, they already had a drummer, and he worked at the home, too, and that just kind of left singing.
Right.
But I saw them play, and I said, well, if they had a monkey jumping out in front of them with this music, I think it could go somewhere.
And you volunteered yourself.
Yes, I did.
Absolutely. So, and then, if I remember correctly, you guys sang, did you ever sing together a few shows? Was that, you and Norm both sang, didn't you, at any point?
No. No, I kind of convinced him that singing wasn't his thing, that he probably doesn't enjoy it much, and if he ever changed his mind, well, I'm available. But there was this other guy, Chris Letcher. He wanted to sing, too. So for a while, we never played in public, but for a few months in practice, we had two singers.
Okay. Hmm.
And he was more into Ian Curtis kind of a deal.
Right.
That's.
So if we ever would have done that live, it actually would have been pretty cool, because he was singing completely different shit than I was.
But had you been in, you'd never been in a band before yourself?
Oh, no.
And you just knew that you could do it better?
Well.
Or that you would be more animated?
Yeah, it made me feel funny inside, so I figured if I got up there, the combination of the music and people staring at me and being on acid would probably, I would do all right.
Did you do your first show on acid?
For the first several years, we did every practice and every show on acid, yes.
See, kids, if you want to make it, if you want to make it in the business, you got to be dedicated.
Don't do what we done.
Obviously, I'm sure you remember the first time that you actually went up and... The only reason I bring this up is I just started a band for the first time in my life, and I'm singing, and it was when the first song was being clicked off, and I had this huge thought in my head that said, you have no fucking idea what to do. And then as soon as the song started, I just immediately went into something. Did you have a similar experience in that? Did you?
No, I actually had the opposite experience. Our first show was at... We played in somebody's basement at a house party, and I was completely cocky and like, I got this and no problem. And as soon as we hit the first note, I almost fainted. I blacked out and I fell down. Very nervous.
Did you get up and finish?
Eventually.
Okay.
But Drew, were you on acid when you were singing?
I was not. I hadn't even drank a beer or anything. I decided to be stone sober.
Wait a minute. What?
Yeah.
I don't want to talk to you about this anymore. But so the people that didn't get to see you guys were notorious, you specifically, for Madness live. Was that something, growing up, were you a fan of music? Was there something that inspired the showmanship? Or was it just something you knew, like, in order for this to make sense, I got to be a fucking lunatic? Or is it just kind of, like you said with David, a one-upsmanship kind of game? Like, you wanted to always be the one that people remembered?
No. The idea behind it was actually that the idea behind our music was very much kind of fuck the world and live in the moment, and people have a tendency to start thinking if they get a chance during your show, and as soon as they start thinking, they're not really present. So the idea behind me doing what I did was to pretty much keep people off balance and keep them in the moment.
So it was an attention keeper for the audience.
Yeah, so their mind didn't wander, and
yeah, I mean, it's a way to what? Interrupt their thoughts so you can have their entire...
Well, if you don't know if I'm going to do something to you, or Kevin's going to do something, or Thor's going to... I mean, if you're totally off balance, you the seconds click off individually. You're there as it's happening.
You're stuck in it.
In the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I was reading that in an interview that you had done recently where you were talking about people sitting there, and once they hear the music long enough, they start to develop comparisons, and that's when they start tuning out.
Yeah, starting probably in the late 90s, and then ever more so, everybody wants to... They've seen so many shows from such a young age that their first instinct now is to... Well, I got these guys pegged. I pegged them in two songs. How long did it take you? Well, yeah. I pegged them right away. They're a combination of this band, and this band. I mean, then they're really not present.
Yeah.
And next thing they know, they get a cigarette in the face and they wake the fuck up.
Right.
God only hopes.
We're going to play a cow song now. This song is called Hitting the Wall.
I'm only 20. Well, I'm 27. Okay. forgot.
Once you pass 25, it doesn't matter, man.
Well, I feel like a total shithead because, you know, the first show I went to, I was 13, and I went to like a... Well,
you can't help when you were born.
What's that?
Probably no one could.
You can't help when your parents fuck.
Well, that's what I mean. I can't help it. I don't feel like a...
You can help when your parents fuck now.
That's true. I could run in and scream. Please light things on fire, whatever I have to do. But... I mean,
it's harder than it sounds.
It's harder to make them
interrupting
fuck.
Interrupting your parents fuck? Yeah, it's probably harder
Is it harder to make your parents fuck or to stop them from fucking once they start?
Or is this addressed specifically to me?
I don't care.
I mean, my parents
are
listening.
Finish your point.
Well, my point is more or less that I meet all sorts of people that have grown up seeing bands that really did something a little different at the time. And to me, like, I don't know. I don't have any of that. There weren't really many bands that I saw that really kind of like blew my top, so to say.
Well, that's why we started doing it, because no one else was doing it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's still possible for people to do that, or do you think...
Boy, I don't know.
There's just too much shit that's been shoved in our faces.
Yeah,
that's
a great question.
It's kind of like somebody shouting over a crowd of people who are already screaming as loud as they can, you know?
Well, no, now if you start doing that, they go, oh, yeah, this is one of those fucking bands that starts shit on fire.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a bummer.
There's very few genres of music that over time get more respectable. You know, like at the time, I'm sure people liked fucking Aldo Nova or some shit, but then, you know, now we just go, oh, that was stupid. But like that specific genre of music that you guys were pretty much the front runners of is still looked at today. Every time Hazelmeyer does any sort of AMRAP related shit, every time the Melvins come to town, every time Helmet comes back to town, anytime you know, like Boss Hogg's getting back to all this shit, anytime that stuff comes back, everybody goes, fuck yeah, man, that was an awesome time in music. That was a great time for the city, for the whole fucking Midwest, for the whole country in music. Well, it does. It sucks, but it's cool that, like you said, you couldn't do it again. If anybody did it again, if I went to a show and somebody walked out in a funny costume, I'd say, well, that dude's just pulling a fucking Janet Selberg. He's, you know, it's been done before. Anytime a guy...
We got Suicide Commandos when we started.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Who I never saw. Or Iggy Pop, who I had never even listened to one of his albums at the time. You're trying to be Iggy Pop. I am?
It's kind of going to be tough. I don't know who the fuck he is. So, what did you listen to growing up? What did spark your interest
in
music?
It's a lot of funk, right? If I'm not mistaken?
Right, yeah. Uh-huh. I kind of grew up in the hood. And, yeah, I didn't like rock music growing up.
Is that the hood here in Minneapolis?
No, it's kind of funny. It wasn't a hood. It was a low-income housing project in Fridley.
That's the hood. Where was that?
In Fridley, Rice Creek townhouses.
Oh, my goodness. That's balls deep in the hood.
Mm. It is now. It wasn't back then.
Really public housing.
Or so I hear.
No, so you listened to...
When I'm old, that was in the 70s, so I was into, you know, the Barquets and Parliament and James Brown and stuff like that.
Feel like that rubbed off on the showmanship side of it, or just
definitely,
yeah,
yeah. We always pictured ourselves as more like the Cows. We always thought of ourselves as like a blues band, and we figured we could do this shit till we're 60 because we're a blues band,
right?
Well, that's how out of it we were.
Strike up a set at Famous Dave's.
Oh, that would turn some heads. Well, that's the thing. There's that quote that I think it's on. What the fuck am I talking about? Pitchfork or something.
Casablanca?
A show reviewed said, I have no doubt that the Cows know how to play their instruments. I just don't know why they refuse to tune them.
They tuned them.
No, that was the thing. Is you can tell that they're fucking decent musicians. And like you said, it's just a lot of it is very bluesy. A lot of it is rooted in, you know, good old-fashioned rock and roll.
No, I'm not even shitting you. We really thought we were a blues band.
I believe it. I totally believe it. Well, that's the thing is for somebody who never sang in a band, you're a very interesting approach to putting vocals on some of those songs, because you listen to you take the vocals out of some of those songs, it's pretty mad. It's chaotic. And I don't know how you would, you know, find a discernible melody in some of those songs is pretty impressive for somebody who'd never sang in a band before to just jump in, especially on you know, fucking like Taint and on those early records, like for some to put melody lines over noisy shit like that, it's pretty fucking cool. And where do you think that vocal style comes from that you developed?
Well, originally I was trying to sing like HR from the Bad Brains, mm-hmm. but I don't nearly have the pipes he has.
but
usually I right. But eventually I learned how to sing just by default because. The thing is, we would practice, and I would be screaming, and we practiced 3-4 times a week, and we would stop when I started bleeding from the throat.
That's a good time to stop.
So after about a half hour to an hour, I would start spitting in my hand, and when Red showed up, all right, 3 or 4 more songs, you guys. That's it.
But is actual soul in there? I mean, is that something you're just born with, or is that something you can develop?
I wouldn't know.
I had read something that you had talked about not having a specific voice when you sang. And, I mean, definitely in a lot of your songs, you do range from being completely over the top to being a little more subdued and a little more melodic. And I had read also that you had kind of had some sort of foray into acting at some point. I don't know if you still do or not, but I mean, the way I see it, like, singing, fronting a band is sort of a form of acting, depending on what's going on, because you get caught up in, well, you get caught up in your own music, you get caught up in your own lyrics, and different things come out at different times. Is that sort of the idea behind not having a distinct voice or not having, you know, a particular style that you always stick to and kind of bouncing around the board?
Well, it really wasn't that self-conscious at all. What we would do is, usually Kevin would start a riff, and, you know, it'd be a strong riff, and then Thor, I don't know if you noticed, but he hardly ever plays what Kevin's playing.
No, never, yeah.
On the bass. So basically, he's stealing the riff from Kevin. So meanwhile, I got two guys playing different songs, and my idea is, well, I'm going to steal the riff from both of them. So you got three strong counter things going on.
And it's a very astute singer that can actually take, like you said, take two different riffs from a song and put a melody on top of them and find those open areas.
I'm glad you noticed them.
Well, but there's things, because I have the same problem where when
it was very difficult.
Well, yeah, well, of course it's like I was listening to what the fuck record? I was listening to just going over the old Gold record the other day, just like fucking, because that was like my Bible. Because when I was at it, you couldn't get all the records, but then when the old Gold came out, I was like, oh fuck yeah, it's, you know, all the good stuff's right here. But I was listening to that, and I was like, a lot of the shit, I would, as a vocalist going into it blind, I would have no fucking clue what to do. I'm literally handcuffed. How do you sing over this? I would have no idea. It's
make your own path, I guess.
It's a very interesting approach to music.
I'm glad you noticed. Most people tend to think I'm some kind of pig fuck idiot.
No. Okay, so do you want to drop a song in real quick?
All right, here's another cow song. This one's called Finished Again.
Record with AmRep was the Taint record, right?
No, that was on Treehouse.
Okay, right? Then the first record with them was...
Daddy Has a Tale.
That's right. It was the first one on... That was 87, 88? Close to around there?
88, 89.
So how do you get hooked up with Hazelmeyer and Dwyer and all that shit?
Kevin lived next door to Tom Hazelmeyer, and we were on Treehouse, and we kept trying to get him to do another album, and he never seemed to have the money to do it. And so we kind of took a walk, and we sent our stuff to Touch and Go, and we got a nasty letter back that said it all sounds like waltzes, and they didn't like it.
I hope you frame that.
And then, probably threw it away or something, but Hazelmeyer really liked Chow, and he liked Camouflage Monkey, because he was in the Marines.
It's an amazing song.
And so he started putting us out.
It was that easy? That was back when it was just a few bands on the label, and it was...
Yeah, we were one of the... I think we were the first Minnesota band on there besides Halo Flies.
Hmm. Which is Tom's other band. Or his band. All right, so Daddy Has a Tale comes out, we'll say 88, maybe 87, like that. What was the response, and how did you guys get rolling in the city here? I mean, did you tour a lot, or were you playing locally most of the time?
Well, we got lucky because... The Chow single came out, and we decided we were going to do an East Coast tour, and it was all headlining shows, and, we didn't know anything, so we just went out there. And,
how old are you at this time, by the way? Sorry.
Probably 28, 29. Okay. I didn't start till I was 27.
Okay.
So, kids, there's always a future.
I was wondering if you're... There's a difference between being, 20 and touring and being, 30 and doing it. It's like, oh, it's a different ball game.
Well, I was a little immature for my age.
I think that helps.
But no, we went out to tour Chow, and everywhere we went, it was packed.
Cool.
Because apparently that was some kind of big underground hit. So we didn't know from fuck all. I'm like, wow, touring's great. So, I don't see what's so hard about this.
Was it a surprise each time you showed up to a show and discovered there was a good amount of people there? Or
no.
Did you kind of expect it going out? Headlining?
We expected it was kind of suck and it might be half full, but we really didn't think about it. We just did it.
Right.
And we got lucky. I mean, we started here opening for Run Westy Run, and we were friends with them, and none of the clubs wanted us to play, but Run Westy Run would insist, or they weren't going to play.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we would have died on the vine, but... it was a time when the Replacements and Who's Could Do It kind of gone pop, and
right.
That kind of pissed us off, so we walked into Treehouse Records, and we weren't popular in the scene kind of guys, and we just said, we're taking over, see? So the reason he signed us is because all these people started coming into his record store, and half of them hated the shit out of us, and half of them thought we were the greatest thing ever.
So do you think that was required at that time, being that both Husker Du and Replacements had softened up quite a bit? And there, did you guys just kind of become heirs to the throne of, like, insane, chaotic music, more or less?
Well, just there like wasn't any music rock being made that we liked, so we made it ourselves.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
We were just stupid enough to think we could just saunter in and take over. And so we started doing good here, and our first tour, we were headlining, and that did great, so we were never really beat down like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we just assumed that we could do whatever the fuck we want. In fact, those guys, after a couple of shows with me singing, they wanted to quit. They wanted to break up.
The rest of the band did?
Yeah.
Why?
I said, well, this is fun and everything, shit, but I don't know really where this is going. And I said, well, no, you guys don't get it. I mean, we can do whatever the fuck we want. And as a matter of fact, we're going to tour America. We are going to tour Europe. We are going to get paid. All those guys in your record collection, you will know on a first name basis. They will be your friends.
Weren't,
and they kind of shook their head like I was crazy. Yeah, okay, we'll play a few more shows. All right.
Well, weren't those guys all students and all that?
Well, so was I.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, we were all going to school to be teachers.
Huh. So you were that confident in the band that you were able to forego the...
Well, I figured if I liked it that much, everybody would.
that's the way to go. So you tour the East Coast, first time, it's fucking ball, everything's sold out, you come back home, Are you guys bigger back home? Are you? Where are you playing back here?
We were playing the like pretty quickly. We were getting packed shows in the entry and setting records for alcohol sales.
Not just from the band.
Yeah, I think you're still setting records for alcohol sales.
We were the only noise band that would headline in the entry.
Right. Did you notice? So then, I mean, then you've got.
In the main room.
Right. Yeah. So you got, like we were saying before, you know, you get the scratch acids and rape men and that kind of whole stuff. But do you guys feel like that was almost because of you that was successful?
Oh, no. Not at all.
So you guys more or less brought that to here, but you did it out of nowhere.
We didn't bring it to here. We just did it. Yeah. I mean, it was very unself-conscious.
Right. You guys just kind of, that was what you wanted to do.
This is what we like. We drop acid, we practice, we write songs, and then we play them for people.
Write it down, kids.
In crayon.
All right. And so now you're on AMREP. You're doing good. Hometown boys do good kind of thing. You guys put out a record almost, what, every year?
Yes.
For, what, 5-6 years?
Longer than that.
How the fuck is that possible?
Well, it kind of falls into a rhythm. You write an album, and then you tour it, and you write a couple of songs in between tours, and then you tour again, and then it's time to put out an album, and you put one out, and then you tour it twice, and then you write another one.
Are you writing on the road, or are you writing at home? Or?
No, we would... The thing about the cows is that every... I don't know if anybody noticed this, but every year our set list would basically completely change because we would play two-thirds stuff off the new album all the time. So,
and you had the luxury of having, I think sometimes people get handcuffed to quote-unquote hits. If you have like a video for a song, people want to hear that song. I think you guys were more of an experienced band. So people don't get mad if you don't play the hits or all the, you know.
No, you're right, new hits. Songs.
Yeah, exactly. So when your new album comes out, that's the shit you're excited about. So you guys are putting out an album every year, and that's what you guys want to play. So I'm assuming that people that loved, you know, the first record, by the time the fourth record comes out, they're only getting one song or two songs off the first record.
Yes.
And that's because you guys were, I mean, I don't know any bands now that could put out a record every fucking year. It would be impossible at this point, I think.
Well, the thing was at the time, too, is that every time we put out a new album, everybody would say, well, I like your other albums, but I don't know if I like this one.
Right.
But then by the time we were touring a new album, it's like, well, I like that album a lot, but I don't know about this one. It always, like Cunning Stunts, when it came out, everybody was, it wasn't self-evident that was our big album, and when it came out, I was like, well, this is a lot more mainstream than the other stuff. I don't know if I like it.
Do you like, he was asking before, do you get that a lot? Do you feel like that was your big mainstream album?
It wasn't mainstream, but that seems to be the one that critics seem to think is the best one.
That's funny. I always thought Horn was the one, the one that...
Now, see, that's my least favorite.
Really? Well, why is that?
Doesn't have the best songs on it.
Maybe I'm just too close.
Very rational explanation.
It's not quite as good. No, well, you know, I think there's songs in there that are amazing. I think No Moss is an amazing song.
Yeah, No Moss is. Yeah,
really? I mean, the lyrics in that song are phenomenal. I used to, when I was a fucking dumb, shitty high school kid, I used to write the lyrics to that song on my fucking notebooks. I loved that song.
You
that
would
song,
still be, I'm sure you're still doing that at
four. The Arcteryx of all future fashion?
Yes, exactly. I think that song, I think The Warden's a fucking cool song. Obviously, Four Things is a cool song. Divorce Amor is great. I think there's a, whatever.
You're right, goddamn.
Fucking is. Put them all on right now. No, I think that, but no.
Let's play all the songs at once, Pete.
Play all the songs on Horn and Cunning Stunts together at once. And we'll decide what's best. I'm hot as fuck. You guys want to take a break real quick?
Sure. All sure. Right. This song is called Mas No Mas.
Future passion!
Comedy Stunts, Sexy Peace Story, Orphan Tragedy. These are all the 90s records, right? Which leads up to Horn, and then the last record, which was maybe the most...
Sorry and Pig Mine?
Maybe the most underrated record of you guys is?
That's my favorite one.
That's what I was just going to say. That was the record that I think that if that would have been someone's introduction to the band, they'd have been like, oh, fuck yeah. Yep. But you were just saying now, off the air, that was kind of, you know, heading towards the end. Do you want to tell...
We knew we were doomed probably at that point.
And why is that?
It had been, 12 years we'd been at it, and
sorry.
Like I was saying in the break, that's an awful long time to keep four alpha males together,
yeah,
doing this, pointed in the same direction. And
so
I had moved to New York, and then Kevin was moving to New York, and yeah, it was just kind of coming apart.
Did you know it was coming, or was it kind of like fuck you, and fuck you, or was it just like this is, you know, we've hit our peak, it's over now?
Nah, we could feel it kind of spinning apart, and you know, times were changing, and the audiences were changing, and I mean, it was a miracle we even did that one. But they wrote it. But they wrote the music here, and they sent me tapes out of New York.
But the first song on that Cabin Man, the first song on the record, mm-hmm. is a 5-minute almost spoken word thing.
Yeah, I love that.
It's genius. It's storytelling. It feels like that was when the band was really starting to go, like, okay, going from here on out, it's going to be fucking balls out. Did you guys know, like, we're hitting our creative peak, it's over, or we're hitting our creative peak, it's going to be fucking awesome from here out? Did you have any idea that that was...
Well, wasn't there a song written on that album? You'd written in that letter where you kind of were retiring unofficially.
Death in the Tall Weeds.
Yeah, exactly. You had said that was basically... basically a song that was saying, like, look, we're dying, our fans are dying.
Well, this is it.
Yeah, this is it.
Talk
and
about...
And so it was finished again. And mm-hmm. A lot of the songs on there are just kind of about the end of things.
Talk a teeny bit about dying.
I don't know.
About making that record, though. I mean, that's kind of... It's kind of gotten its way. That's the way in, like, you know, Paul's Boutique, that Beastie Boys record is now like there, and like Pinkerton, that fucking Weezer record is now like there. They're classic records. It's kind of seems
that was more like our Zen Arcade. Like, Husker Du didn't break up then, but
that was a
like,
great. They love Zen Arcade quite a bit.
That was my favorite record by them.
Yeah,
and that was a matter of like whatever they used to be was kind of dying, gone, and they knew it, and then things were kind of falling apart, and then
things fell apart.
There's a lot of emotion that gets kind of stuffed in there.
Well, how long was the recording process for that record?
Like 4 or 5 days.
4 days. You were living in New York, and they were sending you tapes.
Yeah,
and it was four
they sent
five.
Me tapes to write the lyrics, and then I couldn't think of anything, so I came out of here and just kind of winged it.
Damn, that's
kind of wrote a lot of it on the spot.
It seems like you're a storyteller. A lot of the songs are just
sometimes.
It seems like, I mean, are you a reader?
Whatever the music is making me think of, that's what I make the song.
Because I mean, you have lines, you know, like in Shaking, "Yo, girl, I love when you make my asshole bleed."
Yeah, because that's stuff so stupid. Like I didn't know the real.
No,
lyrics.
You got that. You get.
So I made some up.
You get that versus
who
like
doesn't know the lyrics to Shaking all over.
That's what I'm saying. But like you get that versus songs where it's really detailed 6-minute stories, like arcs and peaks and
is that something that's
all this shit? It's a storytelling thing.
Is that something more or less preconceived that you then bring to the table and adapt to the music?
Imagine like the music is a soundtrack to a movie, but they haven't made the movie yet.
Okay.
It's like you got to fill in like the visuals.
So you get pictures in your head kind of what's going on,
right,
thematically.
Yeah, this reminds me of so-and-so, whatever the subject is, and then I write lyrics about it.
Okay.
Or sometimes I also write a lot of short stories, which I then vandalize for, you know, I use for parts.
Okay. Do you do a lot of writing or anything? What do you do here artistically in Minneapolis now? Do you do anything?
Yeah, I'm working on a novel.
Are you? Can you tell us a little bit about it?
No, not really.
Fair enough.
Now, if you talk about stuff, then you don't do it.
That's a good point.
Yeah. Well, that you mentioned
I should stop talking permanently.
No, you mentioned.
Don't be that way, baby. You're doing great.
Thanks.
You mentioned
thanks a lot.
The move to New York, and this is when Heroin Chic started as 98, 99.
Well, the college was still going, yeah, but I just couldn't stand the idea of one more winter in Minneapolis.
Sure. Well, the New York winter is pretty bad.
Not compared to here at all.
Hmm.
The first year I was there, it didn't even snow.
So what was the impetus for moving to New York? You couldn't take the winters here. You wanted to change artistically. You wanted to do acting. You wanted to do...
No, I really wanted to get out of here, and then I got a free ride to New York, so I went.
God damn. Seat of the pants guy. So you get to New York.
Yes.
What's the impetus for
Then we did Sorry and Pig Minor, and then we broke up. We did a tour, and then we broke up. And I had some songs that I had written on keyboards that my mom had given me for Christmas. And the cows weren't too interested in them, but I still had them laying around. So that was the start of, like, the Heroin Chics.
Cool.
And then I was such a... Well, how do I put this? It's not arrogant exactly, but I figured I could just walk into New York like I did here and take over, see?
Like how you
so
added
I went
the
up to the guy well, in the Swans and said, do you want to be in a band? I never met him. He said, okay.
Did really? You know you'd never you met him?
No.
Did he know who you were?
He'd heard of me, but he wasn't like a big Cows fan or anything.
So you go to New York, you find people from Swans, you walk in and say, let's do a fucking band. What's the response initially to Heroin Chics in New York?
We did good. Actually, when I got there, it just so happened, like, the Village Voice and magazines like that were saying that rock was dead, it was just white boy music, and it's dead forever and good riddance. But that was the time when us and, like, Gogo Bordello and TV on the Radio and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs.
It was early 2000s.
And Interpol, like, all the... We all started up
all those
at the same
bands
time
opened
with
for
each
you
other.
Guys, yeah.
We opened for them, they opened for us.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, yeah. They were wrong about that, to say the least.
So
but, yeah, I walked in and I went to the clubs and I said, so you want to play here? I was Wednesday opening for the Fuckheads and I, oh no, we want to play on a Saturday in headline, but you haven't even played a show. Well, if you don't want us, we'll go somewhere else. Oh, and we want a lot of money.
See?
Yeah, see?
At any point did you say, keep the change, you filthy animal, or no?
Nah, but my bandmates kept telling me, well, that's just not how you do things in New York. And I said, look, here's how people who book shows at bars, here's the thing. They want to sell booze, we'll sell it. And don't kid yourself. You know, we are booze salesmen, and we're good at it. And here, you know, what they... What makes their life is that they drive a hard bargain with bands, and then afterwards you slap each other on the back, go up to the bar, and have a drink.
Yep.
And, you know, they're not going to be mad at us. Don't worry.
As long as the
booze
gets sold.
They want to have colorful stories to tell to their pals.
Has it taken you a long time to... Has this been perfected to a science in your head, or is this just years of... Well, just seeing how that interaction works between people like that. Being able to say, like, yeah, end up at the bar, have a couple drinks, and people want a story to tell.
No, I just don't give a shit, and I feel very entitled. It's like, why not go for it? I mean, if you're not going for it, are you going to play music that goes for it?
Yeah, well, isn't New York City a little bit of the city of fake it till you make it? Isn't that kind of how a lot of it goes? People walking around with an attitude, and eventually kind of it picks up that way, or am I totally mistaken?
I don't know. Everybody does it different. I mean, these days, everybody seems to want to play like 6 times a month and I don't know, play a show for Stoli Vodka. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's all very
Scion presents,
corporate and
Heroin Chics.
Internet presence and all that.
But
right?
you just,
I'm from Minnesota. Self-promotion isn't really my thing.
Absolutely. Well, you just mentioned some bands that have had, we'll just say... some commercial success. Are you comfortable with the legacy of everybody knowing that you're the real, you specifically are the real article? Will you forego the commercial success and you know, the critical acclaim, the nationwide acclaim? Would you be willing to forego that for 50 years and everyone going, yeah, fucking that dude was the real fucking deal? Is that any sort of comfort to you, any sort of consolation to you?
No, not really. I mean, I can't eat that.
Like, you can't, exactly. But is it in your heart of hearts?
Most people, you'd be surprised how fast people forget.
But I think you're right. But I think that a lot of times that you know, when it comes down to it, there's always going to be people that know, you know, what's right and what's real with music. And I think that there's an obvious pride in knowing the linealogy of a scene or the linealogy of a style or a genre. And if anybody talks about Minneapolis music, I mean, I'm dead serious. I think top five, you got to say fucking Husker Du, if you want to drop in Bob Dylan because he's fucking walked through here one time. You know, Prince, all this shit. I think you guys are right in that conversation, the top five bands that represented the city in a way that nobody else did. I think, I mean...
I'll go further than that. I will say that we wrote more, numerically speaking, we wrote more great songs than any band from here.
That sounds good to me. That's... And again,
but they never play us on the radio here.
They didn't even
review our last album in any of the things.
And it's a slap in the face. But I think now, like I was saying, there's certain genres of music that survive the kind of the gestate over a period of time. That people like us that are our age, I'm gonna be 30 this year. I talk to anybody, I mention fucking Cows. I saw the moment, fucking Cows.
The moment you bring up one of these bands like the Cows to somebody, there was a guy who. I know just very impersonally as a bartender at the Triple Rock, and he sat down next to me just by seeing me once or twice in his life, and we started talking about the AMRAP thing coming up. We started talking about Cows, and the moment that you, and that's actually how I'm kind of friends
that's
with this guy.
Yeah.
That's how we met. The moment you bring up these bands, you're instantly locked in with people.
Yep.
In like not an us versus them type of thing. It's not arrogant like that. It's not
it's
stupid.
Just that you
but it's
get
like
it.
Wow,
you
I can't
it.
Believe
you
that. Yeah, you're someone who really understands the, you know, the brilliance and how special that this time was for music.
And again, this isn't an ass kiss fest. But like I said, that moment that I saw you guys, like I said, that was the most pure response to rock and roll that I've had since that day. And I've seen and played with bands that I've fucking, you know, worshipped. You know, I've, you know, played shows with the Melvins and stuff and fucking hung out with all these people and still have tried to recapture that feeling of that first fucking moment that I was scared at a show. And I'm not talking scared like a fucking, you know, buried alive show. I'm talking scared like...
What's going to happen,
and am I going to get hurt? Am I going to be
excited?
Am I going to get a fucking boner? I don't know what the fuck is going to happen. This is this is an amazing moment. And it was like, and I guess what I'm saying is, when you're by yourself in the dark, is it, like you said, you can't eat it, you can't buy shit with it. Is it in any way comforting knowing that, hey, you know what? I did something that probably very few people in any city, in any town in this country will ever get to do, which is, you know... affect people from a completely natural...
It had an impact.
It was a huge impact.
Well, to be honest, it doesn't really have that sort of effect if, like, living inside of me, I don't see it. And people don't tell me that when I go out.
Do people recognize you, or are you just...
As far as I can see, it seems like I'm forgotten. And
you're just a residual character of Minneapolis.
They don't play me on the radio here. They don't write about it.
I guarantee
you, never exist.
I guarantee that it's more remembered and more revered as the years go on. As music gets more saturated, as it gets more watered down, as it gets more,
forgettable,
fucking shitty. Let me say this.
Like when we were doing it, we weren't. I mean, we get tagged as being part of the AMRAP movement or the noise movement,
right.
But to us,
it was just
we didn't write music to be a part of any time. We wrote stuff so that 20 years ago, you could listen to it and not know what year it was put out.
Mm-hmm.
It was made for like people in the future. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's timeless. And it's fucking rock and roll. It's perfect.
And if it started to sound like a part of something that people would put it in a movement, we would change it.
I don't have any more things that I can say to wrap up how important the Cows were to this scene, to this fucking city, to music, to everything, to me,
cool.
To Drew, I'm assuming. I'm going to give you the last word. I know that you put out, I read the thing that Drew mentioned before that you wrote about kind of a... "quote unquote retirement from music." Is it something that is ever going to come up in your life again? Singing in a band.
It's hard to say. I don't really know who I would play with because people don't. I'm very difficult to work with.
because, like I said, we played every show as if, like, this should be the best show that anybody's ever saw in their life or ever will. And the way I work is that it's not only every show has to be that way, every practice has to be that way.
Yeah, yeah. And you find if you can't live up to that standard,
you
it's not worth doing it.
If you can't play as if there's 5,000 people watching this practice, you're in the wrong band.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets old with people. And it was one thing to do that in the Cows where we came up together and it was our shit. But with the Heroin shit, Cheeks, it's my shit.
Right.
And, you know, it's hard to ask people to stick their neck out that far.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's basically on you.
It's like we got to totally go for it, not give a shit what anyone thinks, and fuck the world. And, yeah, it's hard to keep people when you do that.
Shannon, thank you so much for coming.
Sure.
It was an honor. Man. It was a blast. I can't say enough about the Cows. Anything you know, not even close. Anything you can do to get your hands on the Cows records, go local record stores anywhere, has the shit. Get your hands on every Cows record you can. They're fucking amazing. Shannon Selberg, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
And thanks for the beer.
Yep. We're going to close it out with a Heroin Cheeks song called My Boss.
Dead to Me, Mexico.
The porno on the TV.